thank you, Bill, for your generous welcome, and thank you, everybody, for your hospitality. It's good to be amongst you. I brought my passport, having come up to the deep north from the deep south, anyway. As Bill has said, I'm at the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge, and I hold a chair in biochemistry in the University of Southampton. And of course, everything that I say this evening is based on me, and they take no responsibility for what I'm saying. I'm not necessarily telling party line, although I hope they wouldn't be ashamed of what I'm going to tell you. The Faraday Institute, I haven't brought any literature with me. If you're not familiar with it, just Google search Faraday Institute, Cambridge, and you'll find all about us. We have lots and lots of literature that's available online. I think we have 600 talks now and videos that you might want to listen to. Here's just a sampling of some of the courses we have coming up over the next year. Go on our website and have a look if anything deep down in the Cambridge area interests you. And we're putting a course on in Newcastle that I'm sure Bill will tell you about later. In November, so you get some experience, local experience of Faraday. Questions that people ask frequently, who am I, where do I come from, what makes me, me? How many of you have looked at your family tree, you've done bits of genealogy, and I wonder why you've done it. I've done it as well, and in part it's that I want my children to know the people that I, the generations that came before me. It's partly, I think, because I want to know what's made me. The people who've gone before, maybe they're good characteristics. I've got some of them, and that makes me a little bit better. And maybe the bad things that I make me up, the things that I'm ashamed of, maybe I could blame them. It's not my fault anyway. This is me. And here are six generations of male foxes. Yeah. And what is it in me and my son Martin that I can blame this lot for? There are some things that are clearly not in the genes, which change over time. If we look, we have bow ties and neckties and no ties, and that's not genetic. All of those, though, are, if you like, on the engineering, building, sciences side. There's not anybody from the humanities in my family at all. Is that upbringing or is it genes? These characters all wear glasses. That's probably genetic. My son has 20/20 vision. What's in the genes and what's not? So the profession, the appearance, our character, our location, they're all West Country. You might have gathered from the burr in my voice that I was brought up in Bristol. What of those characteristics of my location and what is in the genes? And can I blame my genes for what I am? I'd frequently travel between London and Cambridge, and on the trains are adverts for a company called 23andMe. And you can take a sample of your cheek cells and send it off on a little stick, and they will tell you little bits about your genetic history, about what your susceptibility to some diseases might be, whether you're likely to suffer from a heart disease, etc. Is it all in our genes? I don't know how many times you've heard people say the phrase, it's in their DNA. The sorts of things that we read in the newspapers, and I'm grateful for Dennis Alexander, who was one of your speakers at the Newcastle course, for drawing some of these up, just taken from the newspapers. The love cheat gene, the gangster gene, the mean gene, from genes to hormones, biology, how it shapes your political behaviour. Cigarettes, it's all in your genes. Gluttony, in your genes. The liberal gene. The happiness gene, all those, is it in your genes? And somebody wrote to The Guardian once and suggested there was something called the geneticism gene, a gene that predisposes some people for thinking that behaviour is determined by your genes. It's in your DNA. It's the sort of thing that it is used to suggest that everything is determined. You've got no choice. Now, here is one of these companies that is not 23andMe, it's a different one, Life Profile. One of my researchers picked this up and got the kit. He was never bold enough to send a sample off to find out. This is, I think, a bit more of a joke. Because this superhero assessment decodes your secret information in your unique DNA, giving you unprecedented insights into where your superpowers lie. And it grades you in terms of your BAM, your Eureka, and your Zoom. It's a bit of a joke. 23andMe, I think, are a serious company. There might be some critiques of some of the things they do, but I think this is not. And there is, if you read the small print very carefully, it tells you it's not a diagnostic test and it's actually a bit of a joke. And if you've got any illness at all, for goodness sake, see a GP. It's in their DNA. People sell things by virtue of it being in their DNA. Here's something I found on the website. It's a Boston University thing. And it's trying to persuade their alumni that it's in their DNA to be generous. You want to make donations. Giving back, it's in their DNA. They build on great relationships. It's in their DNA. As though it's inevitable. It's something you can't get away from. A deterministic view. If you remember nothing else from this evening, and you've got any public voice, whether you're speaking or preaching, whatever, please, for my sake, please never use that phrase. Because businesses and corporations and universities, whatever they may, they don't have DNA. And to suggest that things are determined is really giving rather a wrong impression of what DNA is about. But let's come a little bit closer to the topic. James Watson, one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA, said we used to think that our fate was in the stars. Now we know in large measure it's in our genes. That's what determines, so he says, the way that we are. And here's Richard Dawkins saying, we are machines built by DNA whose purpose is to make more copies of that same DNA. That's exactly what we're here for. We are machines for propagating DNA, and that's its self-sustaining process. It's every living object's sole reason for living. Wow. Really? Is that the sole reason why you're alive, in order to propagate your genes? I mean, there's great interest in having children, but that rather suggests that if you haven't propagated your DNA and passed it on, then you've got no purpose for living. Stuff and nonsense. It doesn't even need any arguing against that, does it? DNA is fascinating. I spent my working life studying that molecule, and I'll try and persuade my students that they should spend their waking hours studying that molecule, but there is more to life. There may not be many things that are more interesting, but it's our common experience, though, is that we have choices, isn't it? Our genes don't control everything that we are and that we do. They might have some influence, but our common experience is that life isn't determined. And from a Christian perspective, free will is implied in many passages. Human responsibility is central to the Christian faith. We make decisions one way or another. It maintains our justice system, gives values to the relationships that we choose, not that are imposed upon us. It ensures moral responsibility before each other and before God. So, Jesus says, everyone will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word they have spoken. You are responsible. At least that's what the Christian faith says. But what about this? Bill mentioned that though everybody knows what DNA is, here is this molecule. It's become an icon of our age. It's amazing what it's been used for. So it's on postage stamps. It's been used for marketing, and don't ask me why. It has actually, it's a perfume. You can buy DNA perfume. It's got no DNA in it, it's just a selling thing. And you can buy DNA perfume for him and DNA perfume for her. And if you look very carefully at the bottle it's shaped in, it's a helix. It is a right-handed helix, but if you look carefully, that's actually a three-stranded helix, whereas, of course, we know that DNA is a double helix. So it's a marketing tool. Step back from it. Let me give you just a little bit of science. What is DNA? And we hear these words, genes and genetics. What's a gene? Well, the biochemists and molecular biologists will argue about the fine details there, but essentially it's a region of DNA that codes for a protein and the bits that control when that protein is expressed. It can be anything between 1,000 and 1,000,000, or maybe even bigger, of these bases, the repeating units. Remember that DNA is A, G, C, and T repeated in a very special order. It can be any one of those long, and the genes then are arranged together on chromosomes. There are big gaps in between them that have all sorts of roles in expression and in packaging. And each of those makes up a chromosome, and we know that we as humans have 23 different chromosomes, hence the 23andMe, the company, that contain about 20,000 genes between them. Our genomes are about 3 billion of these letters long, two copies of it in every cell. So it's an incredibly complicated molecule made of some very simple building blocks. And every cell in your body has the same DNA in it. It's slightly different from the person sat next to you, but every cell has the same DNA. Even though it may be an eye cell, or a gut cell, or a big toe cell, or a brain cell, all have the same DNA, and that's what makes you. It is a fascinating molecule. It's very, very narrow, but actually the DNA in your cells is about 2 meters long, if you put it, stretched it all out, all packaged down into a tiny little cell that's a fraction of a millimeter across, because it is so narrow. If there's about 10 to the 14, that's one with lots of noughts after it. That's about 100 trillion cells in your body. Each of those contains this 2 meters of DNA. So if you were to take all your DNA and stretch it out, it would be about 200 billion kilometers in length in every one of you. And that is enough to get to the sun and back 500 times. Now, just to blow your minds as to the immensity of the scale of the sort of thing we're talking about. It's about 0.6 of a picogram of DNA in each cell, probably about 600 grams of it in each person. So depending on your body mass index, it's about 1% of your body weight, actually, is DNA. What does it do? Well, it's the repository of your genetic information, coding for those proteins. It goes by an intermediary molecule called RNA, and it's coded to make proteins. And the proteins do the metabolism, the structure, the organization, development. And different genes are switched on in different tissues. Different proteins are made so that the proteins in your brain are very different from those in your big toe. There's some that are in common, but lots of different ones. But what actually does it do? It does everything, and yet it does nothing. I could put a pot of DNA on the chair in front of you, and actually dried DNA looks like, you know what a piece of tissue paper looks like when it's been through the washing machine and been dried at the end of it? Just a white mass. That's what DNA looks like. It does nothing by itself, it's just another chemical. But in the context of the cell that it's put in, of course, it then starts to do things. So these genes, are they special about human genes? Are they different from us, from other species? And actually, you've probably heard the figures, 98% of our DNA is the same as that of a chimpanzee. And 40% of your DNA is the same as a banana. and we'll come back to that in a moment. Actually, the genes in a chimpanzee are not very different from ours. What makes us different, actually, is the length of time each one of those genes is switched on or off. So look at the shape of the face of a chimpanzee. It's different from ours because the genes controlling what parts are switched on during development are on for different lengths of time for ours. The genes themselves are very, very similar. In fact, you wouldn't, just by looking at the genes themselves, you might not get much of an impression as to what they do. It's rather like if I showed you this orchestra here, what's it playing? Well, you don't know. Is it playing Beethoven? Is it playing Bach? Is it playing Stockhausen? You don't know. It's the same instruments that are going to make the piece of music. Are there any human genes? Well, there are actually one or two that you can find that are present in humans that aren't present in chimpanzees. You can see some of the progenitors of them. They're the earlier forms of those genes. This is a slide, you need to bother any of the details at all, that talks about one particular one that talks a bit about brain development. It gives folding in the surfaces of the brain, and the more folds there are, the more activity there is. And it's present in ours and not in the chimpanzee. We have sequenced the Neanderthal genome by taking DNA from those old bones, and that it's present in Neanderthals. So it's not unique to humans, it's not in chimpanzees, but it is in Neanderthals. In fact, we now know that something like between 1 and 4% of our genome is related to Neanderthal. No, they are our close cousins. In fact, the data now seems that for one reason or another, Neanderthals probably interbred with ancient Homo sapiens. And I don't know what that says to you when you hear those words and think, yuck, or can't be. I'm not like that. But that's the way the data show it. And those of European origin, because we overlapped with the Neanderthals more, have more Neanderthal DNA in our genomes than those of African origin, who stayed in Africa and didn't interact with them, have almost no Neanderthal DNA in their genome. So Svante Paabo, who's one of the people who sequenced the Neanderthal genome, talked about Neanderthals are not totally extinct. They live on in some of us. Think about what that says for a moment. I'm going to call them social conservatives, but what I mean is white supremacists, not pleasant people, who got hold of that data and said, actually, we as Europeans and North Americans have that Neanderthal DNA. That makes us bigger and stronger and more intelligent, doesn't it? Absolute nonsense. Now, they're taking the data and trying to skew it to make that out of what they want. There is nothing that says that white people are more intelligent than black people. There's nothing that says that we're more highly developed one way or the other. It's interesting that when the human genome was sequenced, and the first draft of it was released in about 2000, a big ceremony between the US government and the British government, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, this is Francis Collins, who was a committed Christian, who was director of the Human Genome Project, the God word slips in. So Bill Clinton says, we're learning the language in which God created life as we look at our genomes. And Francis Collins, it's humbling for me to realize that we've caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book, previously known only to God. We were to glimpse a little bit into what makes us the way we are. But there were various statements at the time that are quite important, saying this genetic information must never be used to stigmatize or discriminate against any individual or group. And as we go through some of the other things I'm going to say, I'll leave you to decide whether we're actually keeping with that promise or not. Is it all in our DNA? We know that there are some things in life that you cannot change. It's determined. And you can see that in the scriptures. Can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? No. Actually, probably by worrying, you can probably take a few hours off of your life. There are some things that are determined. But there are other things that you choose. We've already looked at some passages that refer to that. It's not determined. We can decide. It's not determined whether I have tea or coffee or just water. It's I can make a decision. See, we run the risk of what I call genetic reductionism, a fallacy that says effectively genes are us. We're nothing more than the sum of our genes. We've made DNA into a kind of a god, that as though it controls us, that it's responsible for our destiny. That says we're nothing more than just our genomes, a sort of genetic fatalism that says there's nothing I can do in life to change things. Richard Dawkins said in another one of his books, DNA neither cares nor knows. I agree with that, it's just a chemical. DNA just is. I agree with that, it's just a chemical. But then he goes on, and we dance to its music as though we've got no choice. No. You feel the phrase, and we've already touched on, genes for this, that, and the other. If you hear that phrase, always be skeptical, because most characteristics are the summation of a lot of genes interacting together. There's not even a single gene for height. In fact, the data suggests that there are nearly 700 small variations that control people's heights. Intelligence, there's hundreds of genes that interact together to deal with those connections in your brain that control, that influence intelligence. Even diabetes. At least 36 genes have been suggested as being involved in type 2 diabetes. So it's not a single gene for. In many instances, it's a combination of many genes. But there are some things, some genetic conditions, which are clear in your DNA. So here we have muscular dystrophy, Down syndrome, some colon cancers, some breast cancers, sickle cell disease. If you've got that mutation, then you will have some form of disability. Point mutations, simple changes in the letter code. And here is a single letter change in those 3 billion in the hemoglobin gene that leads with sickle cell disease. So there are point mutations in here. Cystic fibrosis, another example, where just 3 of those letters are missing that gives the commonest form of cystic fibrosis. Sickle cell disease, thalassemia, another example. Sometimes bits of DNA get off of one chromosome and they jump to another one. And it's in the wrong place and things are expressed at the wrong time. And a number of leukemias come from that source. Some genetically inherited diseases are where bits of DNA sort of get expanded and it stutters. So instead of saying the cat sat on the mat, it's the cat sat on the mat. And it messes up lots of expressions of genes. And here are some one or two inherited forms. Some Huntington's disease is probably the most commonly known one amongst those. So if you've got those, in some instances, yes, we can blame our genes. If you've got one of those mutations, it will affect your physiology. When the DNA was first sequenced, one of the sequences was of James Watson, one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA. And Michael Egholm was one of those involved in putting together that sequence, looked at that genome and then said it was so profound how little we were actually able to say to him. To me, it was really proved that this is the beginning, not the end. The DNA, you got some data out of it, but it doesn't tell us everything about who we are. See, DNA is not a blueprint. That's a phrase you'll often hear in the media and in simple textbooks, even in some biochemistry textbooks. It's not a blueprint. It contains the information needed to produce the proteins in our cells, but it's all part of a complex system. They do nothing by themselves. And traits and characteristics emerge between interactions between genes, environmental factors, the way in which we develop, the things that we eat. It contains the information that when combined with other things facilitate the growth and the development of the organism into, as we see, how many cells that's got? Billions of cells. You see, our bodies contain trillions of cells. Our brains contain billions of neurons. And each one of those neurons is probably making thousands of connections. The numbers get mind-blowing as to the possibilities. And all that isn't specified in the DNA. Those are some of those that are things that connections are made, trial and error. What works is kept and what doesn't work is then removed. It's not all specified. But maybe to come a little bit closer to home with some of the things that we're going to look at this evening. Here's a question. Is biology destiny? But look at where that was published. Not a genetics article, but in the International Socialist Review. Yeah. It does the genetics of politics, discovery, challenges, and progress. Does your genetics affect the way that you vote? Does it affect the friendships that you have? Here's in the Journal of Politics. Friendships, moderate an association between a dopamine gene variant and political ideology. And actually, when you look drill down it, there are dopamine is one of the transmitters in your brain, and there are two different forms of the receptor that interacts with that cause it to work. And there is an association between one form of that receptor and whether you're likely to be liberal in political leanings. But that depends on the social environment that you're brought up in. If you lived in a very social environment, you're interacting with a lot of people, it has an effect. If you live in a more isolated environment, then it doesn't. An increasing number of studies, here's a bad publication in a very good journal. So Nature is the premier scientific journal. And a few years ago, this is 2012, An article on the anatomy of politics was published in this. From genes to hormone levels, biology may help to shape political behavior. And look at the phrases in here. An increasing number of studies suggest that biology can exert a significant influence on political beliefs and behaviors. Genes can exert a pull on attitudes concerning topics such as abortion, immigration, the death penalty, and pacifism. So according to that article, if you've got a view on any one of those, you can blame your genes. in that, too, was the phrase from one of the contributors, it's difficult to change someone's mind about a political issue because their reactions are rooted in their physiology. So don't bother debating with people as to whether things are right or wrong. Don't bother arguing the Christian faith one way or the other with people, because it's all in your genes to them. People are made up like that. And it's worth thinking what that does to society when people take that sort of view. Because if you think that your behaviours are determined by your genetics, then there is no point in changing social structures. You can change society and the genetics stays the same and people will be just as bad. So the only way to change society is to change the genetics. And that's where you get the sort of eugenic final solution sort of thing coming through, because you need to change the people and their genes, not the environment that they live in. So beware of some of the consequences of that deterministic view. This isn't something that's new. It's Charles Davenport writing in 1911, talking about eugenics and stopping what he called the simple-minded, feeble-minded and criminalistic, rather than imposing prison sentences on them. It's best that we don't allow them to perpetuate their offspring. This is in this country, and only just over 100 years ago. And in the US, there's a policy that was only overturned, I think, in the 1950s, called the sterilization of the feeble-minded. Three generations of imbeciles are enough, as the article says, published in 1927. It's better for all the world, it says, if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for a crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. That's not that long ago that we're set in a society that's supposed to be fairly liberal. What are their genes for? Are their genes for being criminal? Ladies, can you put your fingers in your ears for a minute? Because this isn't going to be nice for the gentleman. Is there a gene for criminality? Well, yes, there is. If you look at it in a gross level, something like 90% and above that of the inhabitants of jails across the globe are men. And they have the Y chromosome. Ladies, you don't have a Y chromosome. So is there a genetic component to criminality? Well, looks like it. It's having a Y chromosome. But beware, that association doesn't mean it causes criminality. There are lots of blokes here this evening, and I hope you're not criminals. It doesn't cause you to be a criminal. There might be a greater number of men in jail, but having a Y chromosome is perfectly possible to be a very good law-abiding citizen. So is there a gene for criminality? No. Some studies, if you look back a few years ago, there are some men who have two Y chromosomes. They're perfectly normal. They're probably unaware of it. About 1 in 1,000 men have an extra Y chromosome. And there were some studies that suggest that criminality in these where they were more likely to be criminals. That study has since shown to be wrong. If you have a double dose of the Y chromosome, you are no more likely to be a criminal than if you just got a single copy that most men have. Are the genes for aggression? Now, we know that there are things that do affect, chemicals that affect our aggressive tendencies. You know, the flight or fight response, the noradrenaline, when you're up raging to go, that's noradrenaline. And when that's released, it has to be metabolized to get rid of it out of the way. And that's done by a gene called monoamine oxidase, MAO. And if that's got a weak activity, then the noradrenaline will persist for longer, and the net effect is that somebody's more likely to be a bit jumpy and on the go and a bit more aggressive. And we do know that from animal studies, the increased levels of noradrenaline and dopamine, which is a close relative of that, do lead to aggression. A Dutch family was found in the mid-1990s who had a history of aggressive behaviour, and actually they had various mental problems as well, in the men only, throughout several generations. And it's actually found that they have a mutation in that gene for monoamine oxidase. In fact, they have a truncation of it, and it's totally inactive. And there's a correlation in that family between their rather unusual behaviours in the men, and because it's X-linked, and violence. So that Dutch study showed in that family, and as far as I know, there might only be one other case ever recorded across the globe, in that the behaviour is constant throughout several generations, and it seems to be caused by the presence or absence of that form. It's very, very rare. Now, let me give you a consequence of that. Again, in the 1990s, Stephen Mobley murdered a pizza parlour owner. He admitted to the crime, he was quite proud of the fact he'd done it in cold blood. Taken to trial, and his lawyer said, please can we have him tested to see whether he's got the mutant form of that gene that leads to aggression. What would you do if you were the lawyer, if it were the judge? The judge in that case said, no, he may not be tested, because if we had the data, we still wouldn't know what to do with it. So it's best not to know. And actually, one rightly or wrongly, Stephen Mobley eventually went to electric chair. There were other studies done in New Zealand. The Dunedin study looked at a number of children over a number of years, males particularly, not looking at the presence or absence of that gene, but whether they had a strong form or a weak form of that, and looking to see whether they had a violent behaviour. And this is the only graph I'm going to show you. All you need to take home is that there's an interaction between the gene and the environment. If they live in an abusive environment and they have the weak form of the gene, then they're more likely to show antisocial behaviour. But if they've got that gene and they live in a perfectly normal, loving environment, it makes no difference at all. Genes and environment go together. Let me skip past a few. If you're given the information that somebody has a genetic variation and they committed a crime, what would you do with that information? Would you give a lighter sentence because it wasn't their fault? Or would you give a tougher sentence because, well, actually, they're predetermined to be violent or aggressive or criminal, and so we should protect society from them and lock them away? Be guilty before you've even committed a crime, couldn't you? There was a case in Italy where that happened. And the judge gave a lighter sentence on appeal because the genetic data was given. There was an outcry in the science literature afterwards saying that that this isn't just a misuse of scientific data. That you shouldn't be using that sort of information in order to be able to determine that sentencing. Let me get past that as well. Now, the positive side of it. Some people, you know, are very resilient. And here's a Simon Weston. Remember Simon Weston from the Falklands crisis and the terrible injuries he had? Some people have said there's a resilience gene, and I have no idea what gene they're testing of this. And this is something taken from the BBC, where they took Simon and had his DNA tested. Does he have the resilience gene? And there's a long, drawn-out thing as to, yes, Simon, we've tested you, and we're pleased to tell you that you do not have a resilience gene. From somebody who's shown throughout their life total resilience. And the questions down the bottom here in the interview, so how do you feel about this, Simon? And his reply was, I don't know, I think I'm probably leaning towards being slightly happy about that, in the sense that it's sort of the nurture element rather than the nature element. I wanted it to be about who I am, not what I am. It's not what happens, it's what you're prepared to do about it that counts. Right? Not predetermined one way or another. You see, there's no easy answer. All these genetic information is associations from groups of individuals. And when you look at a group, it's very different from looking at an individual. People carry the same genes, but don't have the pathology. Many of those people have the weak form of the monoamine oxidase gene. In fact, I think 30% of male Caucasians have it, but that doesn't mean to say that 30% of males, white Caucasians, show aggressive behaviour. So you've got to be very careful about how you use that sort of information. Genes may affect our potential, but we remain responsible for our actions. Even Richard Dawkins says we are the only ones who can escape from our genes. So we have doctors and social benefits and hospitals, and we can tame and overthrow the tyranny of natural selection of our genes, as he puts it. There's another nice quote. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the story of George Washington, who told his father, "I cannot tell a lie." Yeah? Mark Twain, I rather like this quote, said, "I'm different to Washington. I have a higher, grander standard of principle. Washington could not tell a lie. I can, but I won't." See the subtle difference? I choose. I'm not predetermined. What about belief in God? Now, those of us who are Christians, who have a Christian faith, are we genetically determined to be gullible? There was a book published in 2002, The God Gene, made the front cover of Time magazine. It has never been published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature, and we're 15 years on from that now. And he rather suggests, again, it's a dopamine sort of hypothesis, there's a variant of the system that stores that within the cells, and that he claimed on some psychometric tests, with questionnaires, that religious people had more likely a certain variant of that gene. Again, beware of that. Here's somebody, Carl Zimmer, writing in the Scientific American, rather poo-poos the whole thing, saying a gene that accounts for less than 1% of the variation found in scores of psychological questionnaires designed to measure a factor called self-transcendence, whatever that is, which can signify everything from belonging to the Green Party to believing in extrasensory perception, according to one unpublished, unreplicated study. In other words, it's a load of stuff and nonsense, right? And if you want a bit of fun, Google search for fun facts. If you think there is a gene for being religious, then of course we could develop a vaccine against that gene, couldn't we? And think what might happen in those areas of the world where there is religious strife and religious fundamentalism that's causing all the problems. Well, we could spray them with this vaccine and everything would quiet down, wouldn't it? And if you Google search, you'll find a spoof FBI briefing that says that's what they're going to do. And it is a hoax. As John Polkinghorne, who was a professor of physics in Cambridge and then became ordained and has been eminent in the whole science religion field, says, the idea of the God gene goes against my personal theological convictions. You can't cut faith down to the lowest common denominator. It shows the poverty of such reductionist thinking. And I rather like Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Project, says, I've evolved from being a committed atheist in my 20s to being a firm believer in my 50s. During my conversion, there is no evidence that my DNA changed. The notion that spirituality is hardwired cannot be entirely correct. You see, there are genes that might affect some things. Some people are risk takers and some are not, and that might be genetic. But there's no gene for driving Volvos as opposed to Fiats. There's no gene for Hinduism as opposed to Buddhism, as opposed to Christianity or atheism. These are decisions that we make. In fact, we now know a lot about an area of science called epigenetics, which is the way in which our genome is modified over time. Tags are put on those genes that switch them on or switch them off. The actual gene sequence doesn't change. The little markers are put on them. And those vary according to your environment, the conditions you're in, the experiences that you have. So again, Time magazine, why your DNA isn't your destiny. The new science of epigenetics reveals how the choices that you make can change your genes and those of your kids. So we're responsible for the things we do. You see, the infant brain is not just a small version of the adult brain. It develops, it self-organizes according to the stimuli that it's given. And if for various medical reasons, if a young child can't hear and then you subsequently restore their hearing, it never recovers properly because the synaptic connections have not been made. Similarly for language and for light and for sound, we learn. So 100% of our phenotype, that's what we are, of any complex organism involves 100% genetics and 100% environment. You can't separate those two out. The interactions continue during life as well. You may have heard that London taxi drivers have a certain area of their brain called the hippocampus that is slightly larger than most of the normal population. And that's because it's to do with learning and memory. And London taxi drivers need spatial maps in their brain of the complexity of London that you and I don't need. And this is something with experience and with practice, that area of the brain grows. Similarly, those who are musicians, for repeated practice at musical instruments, areas of their brain develop. Our genes interact with the environment that we're put in. Genes affect our potential, but they don't alone determine or define it. They provide the potential for personhood, but they alone don't make us human. The genome is a remarkable thing, that it interacts with the environment that we're in, and it supports what we might call social learning. It supports development. As the people that we interact with, things that we do, we're creatures of habit. So others have written, saying we must insist that a full understanding of the human condition demands an integration of the biological and the social, in which neither is given primacy or ontological priority over the other. And there's a rather fascinating book published about 10 years ago by Ted Peters, who is a philosopher, theologian, Playing God, Genetic Determinism and Human Freedom. One of the people involved in the original sequencing, or development of sequencing technologies, Walter Gilbert. So here's somebody, as far as I know, of no particular faith. So genetic information does not dictate everything about us. We are not slaves to that information. We must see beyond the first reaction that we're consequences of our genes. That shallow genetic determinism is unwise and untrue. It takes much more than genes to make us human. You see, a Christian would say we're made in the image of God. Now, what does that mean? It clearly doesn't mean that God looks like us in terms of having two eyes and a nose and a mouth and four limbs. No, we're 98% similar in our genomes to chimpanzees, but that doesn't mean that chimpanzees are 98% made in the image of God, or bananas 40% in the image of God. See, God is spirit, not flesh and blood. God is relational, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit interacting together in the same way that we are relational. And that image of God in us is that our responsibility as God's image for looking after his creation. You see, we're not defined by our chemical makeup, but by relationships. I think it's an African saying, translated, that says a person becomes a person through persons. Now, no man is an island. It's the way that we interact together that affects our behaviours, that affects our learning, that affects the personalities that we are. So just as DNA does nothing except in the context of a cell, and a cell does nothing except in the context of an organism, so we as organisms are less of value unless we're put together with other people interacting together. We define our identity in relationship, and ultimately with God, not just with each other, who knows us and gives us identity and worth and significance. Here's an example of a genetic family tree, if you like. The Apostle Paul, writing in Philippians, gives his genetics, if you like. I'm born of the eighth day of the people of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, proud of my upbringing, etc. But as she says, this means nothing to me. This is all loss for the sake of Christ. There are far more important things in life than my genetic background. And the scriptures are full of things that suggest that things aren't fixed, that they can change. That we become children of God. We have the right to become children of God. Here's that quotation again from Paul in Philippians. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. We're being changed from one glory into another one. If anyone is in Christ, they're a new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. Change is possible. So at that point, I think I will, the theologian Karl Barth put it like this: God in his freedom bestows human freedom. Human freedom is the gift of God, it's the free outpouring of his grace. If you want to read a bit more about genes, determinism, and God, one of my bosses at the Faraday Institute, Dennis Alexander, is coming to speak later on in November, has recently published the book Genes, Determinism of God. And if I was had been clever, I'd have brought some copies to sell for you. But you can find them on Amazon, and I'm sure he'll be bringing some in a few months' time. So I hope I've sort of fired your imaginations at least a little bit, and I'm sure you've got plenty of questions because I've left so many things either explained badly or I've skipped over them. So I thank you for your attention, and we'll take some questions.
For the sake of everybody being able to hear the questions as well as the answers, which will help, if you've got a question, I'll bring the microphone to you. So that it can be amplified for everybody to hear. Otherwise, we have to repeat it from the front. So, if you've got a question or a comment, anything to put into this discussion, please let me know.
I've just got one quick question, which was from, which I just didn't understand. It's, you talked about something being expressed. Can you just fill in a little bit as to what it is and what it impacts?
Yeah, sorry, that's a bit of a biochemist jargon, and apologies for not explaining that. Is that when we have our genome that codes for all those proteins, and certain ones that there are made in certain cells, and expressed, if you like, is that the gene is activated to make the protein. That's what we call the expression of it within some cells, and it's not made in other cells. So some genes are switched on in one cell, silent in another one. And it's the biochemist jargon that uses the word expression that means that it's switched on. Thank you for correcting me on that. That is very, very easy to slip into the lingo.
I never knew what it meant until recently.
You did say at some point that the expression of the genes can be inherited by, you know, you can develop your genes and you can pass that on to your next generation. That sounds a bit like Lamarckian inheritance of acquired characteristic, which has been debunked a long time ago. Are we going back to that?
In a little bit of part. It's that field of epigenetics does say there are some things that you do that will affect your children. And so an example of that, and it's there's a whole field called the developmental origins of health and disease. So the things that happen to you in utero affect your health later on in life. And that's because your DNA is modified in utero. And an example of that is that some of the data from that come from something called the Dutch Hunger Winter, where there was a starvation for a particular period. And if you look for those who are a particular stage of development in utero during that time, they suffer from diseases later on in life. And what happens is that when the fetus is developing, to put it in sort of simple terms, if nutrients are low in supply, then the genes are switched on in such a way that the developing fetus says, if it's there, I've got to keep it, right? Nutrition, diet, it's precious, I've got to keep it. And what happens if you then take those children who are, if you like, epigenetically modified is the wrong word for it, but epigenetically influenced to store everything, they are the ones who are later on in life are more likely to become obese and suffer from all the from heart disease, because their body is saying, keep it. If in utero it's in a fairly well-nourished environment, well, you don't have to keep everything you get because there's plenty around. Those who are in later life more likely to be healthy because they're not, their bodies aren't going to store up and become terribly obese. So there are clear ways in which the things in utero affect the next generation. And some of those modifications we know can actually go into the next generation as well, because those tags that are put on the DNA do stay on them. It's not Lamarckian in the sense, no. So for those who aren't familiar, Lamarck came just before Darwin, and he was the one who said, well, giraffes have long necks because they practice, you know, reaching up to the trees, and because one stretched their neck, so the next generation's neck would be longer, so acquired characteristics would be maintained. So it's not Lamarckian in quite that way, and it's not permanent, and it probably those characteristics fade out after, I would say, at least three generations, they're gone. Some would say it doesn't even go that far. But there are, we do know, at least within the individual, the environment modifies your genes, and if that is affected with your germ cells, then actually it carries on into the next generation as well. So the scriptures talk about the sins of the fathers being visited on the children to the third and fourth generation. Now, I'm stretching the point to say that's epigenetics. But I think it does say that the things that we do, even the things that we eat, affect our offspring. Affects us as well. And that's, in terms of the ways, not just we eat, the things that we do affecting ourselves, I think it's really, really important. Because the ways in which we're creatures of habit, so the things that you read, the things that you look at, actually affect your brain structure. Our brains are, the technical phrase is they're plastic. In other words, connections are being made and lost all the time. And the ones that you repeatedly use, they're being reinforced, and those connections are getting stronger and more often. So it says that the things that you do affect you. So be careful about what you do. Practice good characteristics. Practice what Paul would describe as the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, patience, peace, etc., etc. Because those are self-fulfilling sorts of things. The more you do them, the more it will actually affect the way in which you think. Sorry, that was a very long answer. It was a very
long question. Okay, I was just going to connect on a little bit further and ask you whether you thought that the way we now are with epigenetics means that the whole nature-nurture debate is really not a useful category to use anymore, and if it isn't, how should we talk about the influence of our
biochemistry, supposed to be concerned? Yeah, I think the whole, it's just a nice rhyming couple, isn't it? Nature, nurture. And to have that dichotomy, I think, is something we can no longer talk about. Is that almost everything is that both nature and nurture work hand in hand. Obviously, if you haven't got the gene for something, then the nature side of it says that you are limited in. But for the vast majority of us, in the vast majority of conditions, you can't separate those two out. It's nature and it's nurture together. But because it's a nice rhyming couplet, because it's easy to do, you'll still see that loads of places in the media. If you do a Google search for books with the title Nature, Nurture, there are legions of them. But it's a false dichotomy.
I thought it was interesting that one of your slides said something about it's 100% both.
Yes, exactly.
And it just made me think of Jesus Christ being 100% divine and 100% human as well.
I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but yes, you could say yes. You can't teach them apart.
No. What else? Yes, lady here.
There's no such thing as a silly question, by the way.
Which is what you were probably wondering. Wrong one.
I've been starting to be almost afraid to ask. Is your external appearance, you know, I look in a mirror and I see my mother. I look at my hands and I see my mother. Mm. Is this genes and
yeah, yeah. Last time that is genes, yes. So the ways in which our faces are shaped, and we've all got the same genes that are making our faces. It's the same way as I said for the chimpanzees. It's just very subtle differences in the length when we're developing as to which genes are switched on at which time. It says, no, we've got sharp pointed noses or great long ones or ears that are funny shapes. And that you can see those passed down from one generation to another one. Yes, and lots of those physical characteristics. I look in the mirror and I see my father. Right? And sometimes I look in the mirror and I see my grandfather. And that's genetics. I've got white hair. It used to be black, and it went white when I was in my... But it went white when I was in my early 30s. I went prematurely grey, and that's my maternal grandfather's fault. So yes, lots of those characteristics you can see. But there are other things that, if you like, the mannerisms you have, right? I've watched some of the mannerisms that I have, or my father has, and I find them embarrassing. And then I'm doing the same. Right? And that's because it's in our nature to copy. That's how we learn.
So that is nurture.
That's nurture, yes.
Yeah, but what way do you get people who have been brought up separately in families and in the same?
Yes, I mean, there are the ways in which these studies are done, and you can't... They're opportunistic, because they're often done with twin studies. So it's identical twins who, of course, have exactly the same genomes brought up in different environments.
Yeah.
Now, that it's sad when that happens, but sometimes it does. And you then look and see, now, are they more like each other than those that are non-identical twins brought up in different environments? And there are plenty of things that show, yes, identical. There are many things where being identical twins does affect them. But a lot of what we do is learning.
Behaviourally as well as in terms of appearance?
Less so in terms of behaviour. There are associations. Always be very careful of twin studies. But there are some studies that suggest that predispositions to behaviours, again, it's not a deterministic thing, may be more common between twins. But come back to the sort of ways that we learn language by imitating. And babbling, as children do, as they imitate adults. We learn so many things by imitating our mannerisms. I don't know, I use my hands a lot, so is my dad. And it's embarrassing. But as a child, I watched the way that my father did things, and subconsciously, I just did it. And you can't unpick those things. And it's great that the children look like... Doesn't she look like her mum? Yeah, I think it's nice that we can see family characters. But it very quickly dilutes out, because 50% of my genes come from my father and 50% from my mother. If you go back through, a grandparent has only one quarter, a great grandparent one eighth, a great great grandparent, and so it quickly dilutes out. So to look back at a family photograph from the mid 19th century and say, "Ah, yeah, I look like that," actually, probably.
Isn't the proper comparison for these twin studies one between identical twins separated and identical twins brought up together, rather than the comparison with non-identical twins?
Yes, that's true. Well, you've got to do all the comparisons, actually. It's comparisons between non-identical and identical brought together and separated.
So you can separate out the different influences. Yeah.
But there are, remember, in terms of environment as well, identical twins, we say they're in the same environment in utero, but actually they're not. That's that they have separate umbilical cords, the nutritional supply that each one gets, even in utero, they may be in the same global environment, but the microenvironment each one of those in is actually can be different. And I don't know if you know any identical twins, but they're individual characters, right? And they usually do have ways that you can spot them apart. I was at college with a set of identical twins in different Cambridge colleges, and they would switch roles sometimes just for a joke. But those of us who knew them knew when they'd done it.
Other questions? Yes, John.
Not a medical man, but I understand that we're made up of millions and millions of cells, and our cells break down and replicate or duplicate. So presumably the DNA is duplicated each time. So are there any methods whereby the DNA could be modified? Is that something that researchers do, of actually cutting, stitching, and amending the DNA which is replicated?
You mean ways in which it happens naturally, or ways that we can intervene? This would be a totally different talk that I could give on genetic modification. There are those of you who listened to Radio 4, the Today programme this morning, will have heard something about that, yes? It's in the news. There's a technique called CRISPR-Cas9. It sounds like a cooking oil, but it's not. It's a bit of molecular biology. Developed within the past 5 years, which enables us with very great precision to go into the genome and modify it. So to correct a mistake, as was that case was in the media this morning, or in some instances to snip out a gene that you don't want, or to put in a gene that you do. So we could, that there have been instances, it's never been allowed in any country to do that with an embryo and let the embryo go to term. There are very strict regulations on what it can be done. But it's been done in human cells for correcting thalassemia. I forget what the one, maybe it was thalassemia on the news this morning. So we can do it. And this then becomes, I think, we've opened the Pandora's box. Should we do it? And it's used in molecular biology labs. It's very simple to do for bacteria and plants and for animal cells. It's easy to do, but should we do it, and then so on the early embryo, and let that develop into a person? And the various ways that you can look at it. In one way, it's molecular surgery. We're used to surgery for going to hospital and have things done to us. This is surgery at the level of molecules. And the Christians have always been at the forefront of healing and medicine over the years, caring for the sick, helping them. Developing medicines. And there's a sense in which this is just another mechanism for doing that. But there's another sense which is scary, because this isn't just the ability to change genes that cause disabilities, but to change genes that maybe have cosmetic consequences. I'd rather have blue eyes or brown eyes, not have white hair. The whole question of what should we start to enhance humans and start to fiddle around with, you know, whether it's fast muscle or smooth muscle, whether it's athlete or bodybuilder. There are all kinds of things that get thrown up with that. It also asks questions for us about our attitude to those who are disabled. Right? Because it says, you know, actually we quite like to get rid of those genes in the gene pool. And it's getting close towards saying that we value the disabled people less because of their genetic makeup. So I think there are a whole lot of questions that we have to ask as to whether that technology ever should be allowed to be used. In very few instances does it allow us to do something we can't already do by other means. So the thalassemia thing on the radio this morning, a brilliant piece of science to show we can do it. But actually, if you're going to do it on an embryo, there's embryo screening, pre-implantation genetic testing, where you can test the embryos to say, has it got that defect or not? And then you choose which ones to implant. That's frequently done for certain genetic conditions. This allows us to do nothing more than can be achieved with pre-implantation genetic testing. At that level, it does mean, however, opens, to say, the Pandora's box of what can we do for human enhancement? And the whole eugenic question. And that's a whole big moral dilemma then, as to what does it mean to be human, what does it mean to be valued, what's it to be special? Do we run the risk of a human superclass that's rather different from everybody else? My own view is that we need to have very, very tight regulation about the way in which this should be used. Very tight regulations. Not say it shouldn't be used. There are places and times when I think it is healing, a mechanism of that. But when it comes around to tinkering with the human genome and changing the people that we are,
I think we have to say no, we don't go there. Thank you. That was where you were heading with the question. I could give you another 45-minute talk on that.
If I can pick up on John's question, because I think there was another side to it, if I've interpreted rightly, and that is changes in genes that occur naturally when your cells divide, and that's one way in which mutations occur.
Yeah, I mean, there are mutations that happen. I mean, that's effectively, that's what causes cancer. And so it's mutations arise in cells, mistakes are made during the replication process that mean that some of the control mechanisms that are there in the cell don't operate properly, and the cells, instead of just dividing when they're supposed to, divide uncontrollably, and you get a cancer develops. So most cancers originate from mutations, changes in the DNA. Cancer is a disease of DNA, if you like. And most of the therapies for treating it actually somehow affect DNA. So yes, our cells are prone to damage if those mutations are in any of our germ cells, and of course we pass them on to the next generation. It's the whole swings and roundabouts of the wonder of this created world that we live in. It's that we need mutations in order to be able to drive evolution. But some of those mutations can sometimes have bad consequences for us. For everything in life, there's an upside and a downside. Water refreshes, water drowns. Fire warms, fire burns. Genetic mutations drive evolution. Genetic mutations also give rise to diseases and cancers. So upsides and downsides to so many wonderful things there are.
Speculative question, which is also about faith. Science has changed our life. We've learned how to grow food more efficiently with machines and techniques, and it's made us healthier. We've learned to create poisons that kill us. As genetics, as a science, develops, the potential that would appear to the common man is that in time we should be much more healthy. But the problem of pain is that it's essential to what we as human beings are. Is there a risk that this striving after perfection ends up being contrary to what God intended for us in terms of our experience?
Yes, I think that's true, but it's not just science to blame for that. I think it's the whole of society. It is that there is no correlation between well-being and wealth. There is no correlation between actually well-being and health. There are plenty of people who are unhealthy in the way that we describe, who actually are in pain and suffering and yet live very fulfilled lives and are at peace with themselves. And there are plenty of people who live very affluent lives, perfect physiques, wonderful jobs, and yet are out of sorts. So the incidence of depression in this country, it's a terrible thing when it happens to people. And we treat people and respect them, and it's a condition in the same which any other medical condition is. But it is influenced by the stresses and strains of life that we have and the pressures that are upon us. And there has to be a correlation between the sort of society that we live in and the sorts of things that we see happening to people. So there's a drive in research. So aging, research into aging. We want to live longer. And there's a certain amount of hubris in that and a lack of recognition of the fact that all of us, the one thing that is dead certain, right, is that one day we will all be dead. And that we keep wanting to put that off, let's live longer and longer. And I'm not actually sure that necessarily is correct. We need quality lives for what we have, not quantity of lives.
Aging and health is a big research topic of Newcastle University, of course. But I would say that their primary aim is not for us to live forever, but to have quality aging.
Yes, I mean that's not meaning to knock any.
I didn't take it that you were. I'm just pointing out to this local audience.
Yeah. But if it is, how can we live longer? Then I think that's a fairly fruitless exercise.
How can we live better?
How can we live better? As we age, to be able to age more healthily, if that's a phrase, rather than can we stretch out the years that we live. The longer you live, the more greater the chance you'll get cancer. The longer you live, the greater the chance that you'll get Alzheimer's disease. So, those are...
Because you have to die of something. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I have a colleague who's a professor of nutrition. I asked him a few years ago and said, okay, Bob, what should I eat? Right? Now, you hear all these things, eat meat, eat carbohydrates, eat this, eat that, eat the other. And he said, first choose what you want to die of.
Is that a cheerful note on which? Any further? Yes, Lynn.
This might be a bit stupid. You say we need mutated genes to progress. If you have a mutated gene that's a cancer gene, BRCA1, can you get rid of mutated genes but still move on the human genome?
Right, so the BRCA1, just the breast cancer predisposition gene, it is a fascinating story because, again, it's not deterministic. Your chances of getting breast cancer are much greater if you've got that gene.
It's in the family, then.
Right. There are physical things that people do. There are mastectomies. There may be genetic things that we can do that individual can affect that. We might be able to clip that gene out. We can't at the moment, but some of those. The question I think that it is a difficult one to address is if you're carrying that gene, is would you modify the embryo to take that gene out in the embryo? And I don't have the answer to that.
No, it's very difficult. My husband has it. Our two daughters have got it. We have four grandchildren. So, if we could stop them getting it,
yes.
Then I'd want to. But then I've never wanted to play God, so it's a very...
this is trespassing on the other talk that I give. But there's a lovely example, I think it was published in the journal Nature, of a child who had a congenital form of blindness, an albinism, that meant their sight. They had some sight, but it wasn't very good. She, by virtue of her determinism, she played netball, right, with very poor sight. So she had you can see this sort of concentration she had to go through to do that. And she loved playing netball. And they said to the parents, if before she was born you knew that she was going to be blind, would you have had her genome modified? And they said, yes. And they said, but then they said, now she is born and she's got that characteristic, would you now wish that you'd modified her genome? And they said, no, because it's made her the way that she is. And they asked her as well, Ruthie, I think was her name, and she'd have been, I suppose, a teenager, and they said, if the technology had been available, do you wish that your parents had had your genome modified so that you had impaired sight? And she said, no. It's made me the way that I am. And it's the fact that somebody has some form of disability.
It's not the disability,
it's
so through.
But yeah, but the cancer thing is a difficult one, and I don't have an answer to that, and I think that's a very personal thing. At the moment, we can't do that. Certainly, there are surgical interventions, as I'm sure you're familiar, that can go with that. But we don't have the technology to do that. We probably will have the technology where we could screen embryos. Well, you can screen embryos anyway to say, do they have that gene or not, and choose which ones to implant, because it's all to do with in vitro fertilisation. But we could, again, modify embryos to make sure they didn't have that. And it's a very, it's a personal issue, and I don't have...
So you didn't have that, you could have something else.
Well, yes, I mean, there is no such thing as the perfect genome. All of us have hidden within our genomes all kinds of mutations. If you happen to meet with the wrong person who has the same sort of mutation, then the offspring will have some form of a disability. Now, I don't know what would happen if we had... In fact, if you had a perfect genome, it would mutate anyway. Because they say that in every child has, I think it's the order of 20 new mutations that were not there in the parent. Yeah. 20 mistakes in 3 billion is not very many. Right? And most of those are in regions that don't matter at all, right? That give almost no consequences. So if you had the perfect genome, within one generation you've got 20 mistakes.
I mean, I have never known much about genetics. I've been trying to learn something about it, and I've read that you know, our genomes are full of so many mutations by now. It's a wonder we exist, actually. but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, but the other fascinating thing about our genomes is you can see your history in your genomes. So in the same way as you can construct family trees, you can construct family trees by looking at genomes. And you know, again, this is part of another talk, but if you, you know, you're supposed to take your 5 a day. I'm never sure whether that's 5 grapes or 5 apples, but it's so you are, and the reason for that is because you need to take vitamin C into your diet. You can't make it, right? You don't have the enzymes that do that. If you look in our genomes, you can find the degenerate form of the enzyme that makes the vitamin C. So our ancestors way back in time, this is talking millions of years ago, had the ability to be able to do that. They wouldn't have been Homo sapiens, they'd have been a precursor to Homo sapiens. They'd have had the ability to make it. And because presumably they lived in a fruit-rich environment where it didn't matter if that gene mutated, because they were taking plenty of the vitamin C in anyway in their diet. So you can actually see what we might call molecular fossils in our genome. Plenty of animals have a much better sense of smell than we do. Right? Those of you who've got dogs will be only too familiar with that. And there are genes that specify receptors for smell, olfactory receptors. And our genomes are full of redundant versions of that. Ones that used to be, I say full, that's the wrong one. There are lots of copies there of genes that are no longer active. They've mutated. We don't have that sense of smell. Because we don't need it. So that our genomes say something about our history, of where we've come from.
So I'm coming from a biblical perspective. When we're created, it sounds like we were created to be much better than what we are now, and that in fact we're degrading over the generations. Would that be true?
I don't think so, actually. No. I think the fundamental part of us is what makes us human is not there in our genomes. And I don't think the human stock is degrading over time. But those things are pre-human. Sorry, when I don't want to give the impression there were humans around at some stage who had better senses of smell or better senses of taste or whatever it might be. These would be going back in evolutionary history, well before the time humans and monkeys, say, diverged. You can look at which organisms, and I forget which ones do have that. Guinea pigs don't make vitamin C either. Plenty of insects don't make vitamin C, but there are organisms that do. So you can be, but this is way, way back in evolutionary time. It's not during the time that we've had Homo sapiens sapiens. But no, I think it was a good corrective for me to say that. And there's, it comes back, there is more that makes us human than just our genome. So we're very, very similar to Neanderthals. What form of spirituality Neanderthals had, I've no idea, and I don't think we ever will know. But it's not our genome that makes us human. It is our responsibility before God that, if it acts an act of grace, that makes us human. Being made in God's image and being responsible then for reflecting God's character in the world that we live in. And we do that very badly, and we need more grace.
We've reached 9 o'clock, and we should be drawing to a close. There are one or two things I want to tell you about, but before I do that, to make the recording complete, will you join with me in thanking Keith for coming and giving us this talk, which may be in a subject that is beyond the knowledge and experience of many of us, but I think he's made it very understandable and relevant, and shown something of the importance of it for us. So would you like to join me in thanking you?